On your program, you had the name of Brother Edward Lorenz, and as you all know, we know that he wasn't able to be with us, and so we have provided a substitute, and Brother Wesley Kramer is going to occupy his position. I was asking Brother Wesley this morning about his title, you know, and he gave it to me, and I kind of looked at it, and I'll just let you know what it is. God's Master Contract. And you know, it got me thinking a little bit. There's a lot of contracts in the Bible, but apparently there's got to be a master somewhere. And so Brother Wesley is going to give us that God has a master contract in addition to many other contracts. Lord bless you, Brother.
Thank you, Brother Edmund and Brother Laddie. And once again, we say it's our privilege to greet you with a good morning, and we are very blessed to be in your midst and your presence this weekend. And we, for those who were not here the last 2 days, we once again bring you the loving greetings of your brethren in the Connellsville, Pennsylvania Ecclesia. We do not operate this morning under any delusion that we are a substitute for the speaker that was scheduled for this spot. We would much rather be back where you are, listening to the words of the Lord from his lips. But nevertheless, the Lord knows. He knows what is in our best interest. He knows how to arrange the affairs of our lives. Your God and my God is a God of agreements. He's a God of commitments. He's a God of contracts. And the scriptures have a particular name that they apply to these contracts that we find in the Bible. They're called the covenants. The prophet Hosea tells us that shortly after Adam was created, that God entered into a contract with Adam. What were the terms of this contract? Very simple. Obedience would yield life, and disobedience would yield death. The angels also enjoyed a contractual relationship with God. What's the terms of this contract with the angels? Well, obedience would yield life, and disobedience would yield, for a period of time, incarceration or imprisonment, and eventually to the unrepentant angels, it will result in death. Perhaps the most famous covenant, if you look at the global perspective, in the minds of most people that you would talk with on the street, perhaps the most famous covenant is the one that God made with Noah. And we all know what that covenant means. It's almost like God's signature written across the sky, isn't it, when we see a rainbow. God's covenant, His commitment, His contract, that never again will there be a global flood upon this earth. Never again will the entire race of mankind be obliterated as a result of the waters of a global flood. But friends, these contracts all stand in a very sharp contrast to the great covenants of the Bible. And what are those great covenants of the Bible that you and I have come to know and to love? Well, certainly we have the church's covenant of sacrifice. That's one of the great covenants. The Old Law covenant. Also one of the great covenants of the Bible. And the New Law covenant, that which we are looking forward to being fulfilled. But friends, even these three great covenants, we think, stand in contrast to the greatest contract of all time. And that's the one that God made with Abraham. That's the master contract. That's the chief contract of the Bible. We, in a previous lesson, have explored some of the details of how these four great covenants relate to one another. And perhaps by way of analogy, we can think of, and I know we have a number of brethren here who have been in the construction business, and typically on a large construction project, you have, at least in our area, we call them general contracts between the general contractor and the landowner or the developer. And then you have all these subcontracts. Subcontracts for the plumbing work, subcontracts for the electrical work, subcontracts for the masonry work, subcontracts for the earthwork. Many subcontracts where the landowner or the developer enters into a general contract that covers all of these things, but then the general contractor enters into subcontracts to carry out pieces of what is contained within the general contract. And friends, that's how we analogize the church's covenant of sacrifice, the old law covenant, and the new law covenant as it stands in relationship. These are the subcontracts, so to speak, as they stand in relationship to the Abrahamic covenant, the general contract, the master contract. Our focus today is going to be rather exclusively on the master contract. And there's a few fundamental questions that we want to review. Actually, just two. These are very fundamental. They're very basic. But friends, to us, this lesson was a marvelous revealment to us personally, because as we look through the Bible, we can find references to the Abrahamic covenant many times. And I was always confused. For example, when and where and how did the Abrahamic covenant actually come into existence? When was it actually made? And we're going to explore some of the details of that. And the second question we're going to look at is, what are the terms and the conditions? We think we already know? I thought so too, for me. We appreciated the study on this subject. So let's take a look at the first area that we want to explore, and that is, how and where and when did this Abrahamic covenant come into existence? Well, the scriptures indicate that the Abrahamic covenant came into existence as the result of three steps. And we want to take a look at each of these three. Let's consider some thoughts from Genesis chapter 11 and chapter 12. Genesis chapter 11, verses 31 through chapter 12, verse 5. Now, we want to read these together, but we want to read them in the chronological order in which we believe that they are in actuality. So we're going to read 12, 1 to 3, and then 11, 31 and 32, and then 12, chapter 12, verses 4 and 5. And now the Lord had said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto a land that I will show thee. And I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and curse them that curseth thee, and in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Back up to verses 31 and 32. And Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his son's wife, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth with them from Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan, and they came into Haran, and they dwelt there. And the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. And back down to verses 4 and 5 in chapter 12. So Abram departed as the Lord had spoken unto him, and Lot went with him, and Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. And Abram took Sarah his wife, and Lot his brother's wife, and all their substance that they had gathered, and the souls that they had gotten in Haran, and they went forth to go into the land of Canaan, and into the land of Canaan they came. One item we might mention, I'm going to refer to Abraham consistently as Abraham, even though the establishment of the Abrahamic covenant, as we're going to see, took a period of a half a century to make this contract, to bring it to bring all of its terms, but all three phases into full existence. But during some of that time, he was known as Abram, and of course then he was called the father of many nations. His name was changed to Abraham, sort of in the middle of our process. But we're always going to talk about him, and we're always going to refer to him as Abraham. Okay, St. Stephen confirms that Abraham was in the Ur of the Chaldees when God first approached him in connection with this covenant. Let's consider some thoughts that Stephen shares with us in Acts the 7th chapter, verses 2 to 4. Acts 7, verses 2 to 4. And he said, "Men, brethren, and fathers, hearken. The God of glory appeared unto our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia, before he dwelt in Charan, and said unto him, Get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and come into a land which I shall show thee. Then came he out of the land of the Chaldeans, dwelt in Charan, and from thence, when his father was dead, he removed him into this land wherein ye now dwell." It was here in the Ur of the Chaldees is where God first approached Abraham and made to him a proposal. He made to him an offer. And we see that Abraham responded to God's proposal. And he and his father and his wife and his nephew and their cattle and so on, their belongings, they left the Ur of the Chaldees, and they proceeded to Haran. They headed northwest. We believe it would be in a northwest direction, about 525 miles from the Ur of the Chaldees up to Charan, which today would be going like from Iraq to southern Turkey. Terah took sick and died at Haran, we know. And Abraham, at the age of 75 years, continued to follow the Lord's lead. And then he journeyed from Haran, southern Turkey, down into Canaan, the land of promise, about another 450 miles. A total of about a 1,000-mile journey from Ur to Haran to Canaan. And they didn't have any modern means of transportation back then either. So it was apparently a fairly long journey. Now, with these facts as a background, let's return to our first question. When did the Abrahamic covenant come into existence? Was it when Abraham was in Ur? Was it when he was in Haran? Was it when he set foot in Canaan? Well, in order to answer these questions, we think that it might be useful to understand something about the nature of contracts in general. Now, under our system of thinking, under man's system of jurisprudence, a contract comes into existence when three elements come together. We're going to digress here for a little bit and talk about contracts, because we think that talking about contracts in general will help us to understand how and when and where and so on that the Abrahamic covenant was brought into existence. Three elements. A contract requires an offer. Someone makes somebody an offer. Someone accepts that offer. Second step. And third, there must be what's known as legal consideration. Legal consideration is the glue, so to speak, that keeps the deal together. The technical word is reciprocal legal detriment. It requires reciprocal legal detriment in order to make a contract an enforceable binding commitment. Okay. From the standpoint of offers and acceptances, we have two kinds of contracts. We have unilateral contracts, and we have bilateral contracts. And it's very important to understand the difference between the two kinds in order to understand the Abrahamic covenant. Let's consider a couple of examples that hopefully might illustrate the difference between these two. Let's assume for the moment that I know that, let's say Brother Edmund here, he won't mind if I use him as an example. Let's say that Brother Edmund here, I know that Brother Edmund is very interested in working with his hands. He likes tools and he likes to work with his hands. And let's say I have a bag of tools in my possession, and I don't really know much about tools. So I have this bag of tools and I'm interested in getting rid of them. So I go up to Brother Edmund, and Brother Edmund finds out that I have these. And I say, "Brother Edmund, I have this bag of tools here, and I'm willing to sell them for $50. In fact, I promise you, I'll sell them to you for $50. Brother Edmund says, I'd like to take a look at this. So he opens up the bag and pokes around in there a little bit and says, well, this brother doesn't know what he's got. This is a deal. So he says, I accept your offer. I promise I'll pay you the $50. So now I've promised to Brother Edmund to sell him the tools for $50. Brother Edmund has promised to pay me $50 for the tools. Do we have a contract? Yes. Absolutely yes. It doesn't have to be in writing. Contracts don't have to be in writing to be binding. Verbal contracts are equally contracts just as much as written contracts in most cases. What kind of a contract do we have? It's a bilateral contract. That's exactly right. Why? Because this contract came into existence by the use of a mutual exchange of promises. That's where the buy comes from. Two people are making promises, and these are reciprocal promises. As we said, I promised to sell the tools, promised to give up the tools for $50. Brother Edmund promised to give up $50 to get the tools. We both made promises to each other. And those mutual exchange of promises is what brings this contract into existence. Okay, let's consider an entirely different kind of an example. I suspect that each one of us here have seen an old Western movie from time to time. And frankly, the thing that comes to my mind when I talk about or think about old Westerns is the show, I'm going to date myself here, it was Gunsmoke. It was on years ago, and I used to like to watch that show when I was a youngster. And there's one thing I remember about the show of Gunsmoke, and it was, of course, it was always the good guys versus the bad guys. The guys wearing the white hats and the guys wearing the black hats. Outside Marshal Dillon's office, he had a bulletin board. And on this bulletin board, frequently you would find a poster, and it was a certain kind of a poster. And normally it was a fellow who was sort of grisly looking. And the poster would say, wanted, dead or alive, $500. They put a price on this man's head in order to bring him in. Okay, let's consider this arrangement. Let's analyze the details of this particular kind of contractual arrangement that we're going to talk about. First of all, let's identify the offer. Remember, we need three elements, and we need to find three elements in this example in order to find the existence of a contract in our example. The offer is easy. It's the poster. The poster represents the offer. And if we were to paraphrase or amplify on this offer, it would be something like the marshal promising someone, whomever, unspecified to whom, he says, I promise to give the person who brings this outlaw in and delivers him to my doorstep the sum of $500. Okay, how about the acceptance? How is this offer accepted? It's not made to anybody in particular. It's just out there for anybody to pick up. The acceptance is in the performance. That's how this contract is accepted. That's how this offer is accepted. The person who actually brings in this outlaw to the marshal's doorstep, effectively, by bringing him in, accepts the offer. And there's no contract here at all with anyone until somebody brings in the outlaw, and the person that brings in the outlaw is the one with whom this contract is now made with. And this person would be entitled to his $500. Okay, what happens here? Now we have this offer, we have this promise by the marshal through the poster to pay $500 for this criminal. What happens if Mr. Bounty Hunter, walking down the street, this guy's a professional, right? This is what he does for a living. He goes out and hunts down people who have prices on their head. He sees the poster outside Marshal Dillon's office, and he runs into the marshal's office, and he says, Marshal, I just saw your new poster outside that you're looking for this guy. Marshal, I promise you. As a matter of fact, I guarantee you, I'm going to go out, and I'm going to track this guy down, and I'm going to bring him in, and I'm going to deliver him to you. So now we have the poster being the marshal's offer to pay $500 for the criminal, and we have the bounty hunter making a reciprocal promise that he's going to go get him and bring him in. Do we have a contract? No. There is no contract in this example. Why? Because this is not a bilateral contract. It's a unilateral contract. Remember, the prefix uni means one. In a unilateral contract, only one party is making any promises. Only one party is making promises. And the marshal here is the only one making those promises. He's the only one making any promises at this point. The poster did not ask for a reciprocal promise, did it? What did the poster ask for? The poster asked for delivery, not a promise. It asked for delivery, performance, action, not a promise. Let's talk about perhaps maybe a little bit more modern example for just a moment that perhaps some of us at least have had some experience with. I suspect that there's some amongst us who have sold real estate recently or sometime in our lives, and that we have used a real estate broker or a real estate agent to assist in the occurrence of the performance of that sale. And I suspect that there's some of us in this room have signed listing contracts. A listing contract is the arrangement between you, the property owner, and the broker or the real estate agent that is you're soliciting their assistance to sell the home for you. Now, the listing contract is essentially the offer. It's the offer to do what? Well, if you sign a listing contract, essentially what you're offering to the real estate broker is if you go out and you find me a ready, willing, and able buyer to pay X dollars for this piece of real estate that I own, I will give you a 6% or whatever the commission is. In our area, it's traditionally 6%. I will give you a 6% commission. Okay, what if the real estate agent says, okay, I promise, in fact, I guarantee you, I'm going to go out and get you, I will sell this home for you and I will get your asking price. Is there a contract? No. There's no contract in this example. There's no commitment, there's no obligation on the property owner's part to pay one red cent in commissions until that broker goes out and brings in to the table, literally, to the closing table, a ready, willing, and able buyer. Now, technically, if someone out here knows lots about listing contracts, there are some bilateral components, but we're kind of keeping our example somewhat simple. There are some bilateral elements in a listing contract. But basically, it's a unilateral contract. And the reason is the broker is not entitled to anything until they produce that buyer. The listing contract is essentially only an offer. Friends, we suggest that the Abrahamic covenant is a unilateral contract. And that's the point that we want to get to. What we read in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 to 3, when Abraham was in the Ur of the Chaldees, did not bring the Abrahamic covenant into existence. So what was, or what is, Genesis chapter 12, verses 1, 2, and 3? Where God went to Abraham when he was in the Ur of the Chaldees. It's the offer. And that's the first step in bringing the covenant into existence. And essentially, if we would paraphrase what God said to Abraham when he was in the Ur of the Chaldees, would be something like this. Abraham, if you will leave Ur of Chaldees, if you'll leave most of your family behind, and you move to this new country, someplace that I'm going to show you, someplace you don't know yet, but someplace that I'll show you. If you do that, then I will do A, I will do B, I will do C, and some of the things that we'll talk about in a few minutes. Now, if we assume that Abraham, while he was still in the Ur of the Chaldees, and after God had said this to him, if Abraham would have responded to God, Yahweh, I promise I will go to where you ask me to go. Would that have brought the Abrahamic covenant into existence? No. Not possible. It did not come into existence at that point. Because the Abrahamic covenant, God's proposal, did not ask for a reciprocal promise. It asked for Abraham for performance. It asked Abraham to pick up with some of his family and his belongings and move. And eventually turned out to be about a 1,000-mile journey. The Abrahamic covenant is not a bilateral agreement. Okay, we said that the Abrahamic covenant came into existence in three stages, three steps it took to bring it into existence. The first step was in the Ur of the Chaldees. That was God's offer. That was his proposal. And that's recorded for us in Genesis 1 to 3. Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 to 3. Genesis chapter 11, verses 31 and 32, and Genesis chapter 12, verses 4 and 5, record the second stage in the making of this Abrahamic covenant. And that's the acceptance stage. And as we said, the acceptance of God's offer required Abraham to make and complete the journey that God showed him. We believe that God's covenant became a contract once Abraham stepped foot into Canaan. And when he set foot into Canaan, the Abrahamic covenant came into existence. It was automatic. There was no further promises. There was no further assurances or anything of any kind necessary to bring this covenant, this commitment, into existence. Friends, we suggest, and this is just, I suppose maybe this is a personal preference in how we look at the Abrahamic promise and the Abrahamic covenant. And you know, we refer to those both ways, don't we? We talk about the Abrahamic promise, and we talk about the Abrahamic covenant. And sometimes I think we kind of use those terms interchangeably. This speaker prefers to refer to the Abrahamic promise before Abraham set foot in Canaan. And this speaker prefers to refer to the Abrahamic covenant from the time that Abraham set foot in Canaan, even unto this day, we have the Abrahamic covenant. Now, even though this covenant, we believe, was complete, it was a full contractual arrangement at the time that Abraham set foot in Canaan, we still only have two of the three phases that we believe were involved in completing, in the fullest sense of the word, this contractual commitment. Abraham was about 75 years old when he was approached by God and to have this covenant made with him. Years, we know, pass as we read through Genesis 12 and the subsequent chapters. He was about 75 years old when he left. Many years passed. And as we look through these various chapters, we see that the Abrahamic covenant was referred to by God in various means, in various times. God used different terms to refer to it, but we find it mentioned numerous times in subsequent chapters. And why did God do this? Well, he was shoring up Abraham's faith, and we see that there were outward signs, there were special ceremonies that were associated with these subsequent references by God to Abraham. And through these means, we think that God was reassuring Abraham's faith, kept reassuring him that God was going to fulfill this commitment. At age 86, about 11 years after the covenant was made, Abraham had a son. He was age 86 when he had Ishmael as his son. And 14 years later, we know when Abraham was age 100, Isaac was born. And we have now another 25 years passing to another significant event that we want to reach to at this point. When Abraham became 125 years of age, God gave him his final test of faith. And I would suspect that each one of us here in this room know what that final test consisted of. God asked Abraham to give up his son. He asked him to give up Isaac in sacrifice. Not actually, but he asked him to give him up by faith. Abraham not only endured what had to be a grueling experience, but he passed the test. And God's response to Abraham passing this final test of his faith, God's response comprises the third phase in the full establishment of this contractual commitment that God made. Let's turn to Genesis chapter 22. Genesis chapter 22, verses 15 to 18. We read here, "And the angel of the Lord called unto Abraham out of heaven the second time, and said, By myself have I sworn, saith the Lord, for because thou hast done this thing, and hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, that in blessing I will bless thee, and in multiplying I will multiply thy seed as the stars of heaven, and as the sand which is upon the seashore, and thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemies. And in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because thou hast obeyed my voice." It was a half a century, 50 years after Abraham set foot in Canaan, when God made his oath. And we think that the function of the oath was it was essentially God's seal upon this contract. And God's oath, we suggest, is the third major phase of the full establishment of the Abrahamic covenant. Now, what did God's oath do? What was the purpose of this oath? Did it add new terms to the Abrahamic covenant? No. It didn't add any new terms to the covenant at all. Did it say it was going to somehow do more than what the Abrahamic covenant had originally proposed? No. So then why did God make it? Why did he give him this oath? Why was the oath made? Let's consider the answer that we believe that Paul provides us to this question in Hebrews, the sixth chapter. Hebrews chapter 6, verses 13 to 19. Hebrews 6, 13 through 19. "For when God made promise to Abraham, because he could swear by no greater, he swore by himself, saying, Surely blessing I will bless thee, and multiplying I will multiply thee. And so after he had patiently endured, he obtained the promise. For men verily swear by the greater, and an oath for confirmation is to them an end of all strife. Wherein God, willing more abundantly to show unto the heirs of promise the immutability of his counsel, confirmed it by an oath. That by two immutable things in which it was impossible for God to lie, we might have a strong consolation, who have fled for refuge to lay hold upon the hope set before us." God did not make the oath because somehow there was something left out of the Abrahamic covenant. God did not make the oath and give this oath because somehow there was some kind of deficiency or defect in the Abrahamic covenant. Friends, we believe that the reason that God gave the oath is for your benefit and for my benefit. The oath was to offset any doubt that we who at times can become weak in faith might have, because of two reasons, possibly. Maybe there's others. You know, if in our example, let's say with Brother Edmund and I, or perhaps with Marshall Dillon and the bounty hunter, if the man brought the bounty hunter in, delivered him to the marshal, and 4,000 years passed, and he hadn't gotten his money yet, he'd begin to wonder, wouldn't he, whether this contract was really real. The Abrahamic covenant was made some 4,000 years ago. There's been an awfully long delay in the carrying out of the blessings of the families of the earth, haven't there? Perhaps us who have a tendency to be weak in faith, and perhaps us who have a tendency to apply human thinking and human reasoning to things, might begin to have some doubts. Hey, is this contract ever going to be carried out? And the other reason that we suggest is that our human thinking might also enter into the picture in another way. You know, basically, God's promise, his commitment to Abraham, was essentially a promise to give a gift. It was really a promise to give a gift. You know, in human terms, a promise to give a gift is not binding. It's not enforceable. It's weak. And I suspect that some of us in this room can relate to that. Let's assume for the moment I take out a sheet of paper here and I write at the top of it, my last will and testament. And I start writing. And let's say it's a very simple will. I have $100 to my name. I hereby give, devise, and bequeath $100 to my nephew. I sign it, I put it in writing, it's notarized, it meets all the requirements of a proper will in the state of Illinois. My nephew finds this document while I'm still living. He says, boy, I'm guaranteed this $100. Is he? No. It's a promise to give a gift. And in human terms, when we look at a promise to give a gift, it's not enforceable. I can tear that will up tomorrow. Oh, yes, I put it in writing. I signed it. It looks awfully legal. I made this promise, and my nephew comes along and says, okay, Uncle Wes, I accept. I promise I will receive. Now we have mutual promises. He said, I promise I'll receive. I'll take that $100 from you. It's not a contract. It's not enforceable. It's a promise to give a gift. Why is it not a contract? There's no reciprocal legal detriment. There's no consideration. I agreed to give up something, but what did my nephew agree to give up to get the $100? Nothing. Nothing. And so when we look at this covenant that God made with Abraham, basically, Abraham didn't really do anything to earn this. None of us, no one will ever have done anything to have earned the blessings under that covenant. Didn't work for them. Didn't earn them in a sense of some kind of a wage. And again, and if we looked at this possibly in terms of our human thinking, we'd say, well, gee, this thing maybe doesn't look like it's on too solid a ground as far as its enforceability. But you know, there's an interesting concept. And I think a lot of our legal principles, by the way, that you and I operate as human beings, believe it or not, I believe many of them are extracted from the Scriptures. They're based upon divine principles that were given. God's oath was like a seal. Like a seal. And a seal, believe it or not, on the contract, obviates the need for legal consideration. And the courts of our lands have even recognized that when a seal is put on a contract, a covenant, a commitment, it obviates the need. Does away with the need for legal consideration. A sealed contract is binding even though there is no actual legal consideration, because a seal is the equivalent of legal consideration. You say, well, technically Abraham did give up something. You know, he kind of left a number of his family behind. He probably left some of his possessions behind. And he had to travel all that way. He gave up all that energy and so on. And yeah, technically, maybe there's some a truth to that. But basically, when you cut down through it all, it was really a commitment to make a gift. But God's oath, we believe and we suggest, compensated for any perceived lack of bindingness, if you will, of this commitment, both because of the long delay and because of the fact that it was essentially a promise to give a gift. We think that God swore his oath to clearly show that his covenant with Abraham is not weak. It's not unenforceable. I think God anticipated my skepticism and perhaps your skepticism that we might have at times. He anticipated this. Think about this, friends. He didn't have to give the oath. He didn't add anything to the contract. But think what he did. He condescended down to us. He understands us. He understands where we are and can be weak. And he addressed that. He anticipated what might be a skeptical attitude on our part. And he neutralized that skepticism by providing the oath. And this oath provides you a virtual certainty. If we need one, it provides us with a virtual certainty that this contract is going to be carried out. Paul says that there are two things that are immutable. Both the covenant is immutable, and the oath is immutable. Both, not just the one, but both are immutable. Both are unchangeable. Okay, so that brings us to the third major phase, through the third major phase of the creation of the Abrahamic covenant. We have the offer down in the Ur of the Chaldees. We have the acceptance with the 1,000-mile journey and the entrance into Canaan. And we have the oath provided on Mount Moriah. Three major steps to produce and to create this covenant. Let's consider our second question. Now that we have some idea when and how this commitment came into existence, let's consider the terms of this commitment, this contract. You say, well, gee, that's pretty easy. Thee and thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. What more is there to talk about? Isn't that what we think of when we think of the Abrahamic covenant? Of course. And rightly so. But let's probe this a little bit. We think there might be a little bit more for us to discover in the Abrahamic commitment. In Genesis chapter 12, verses 2 and 3, which we've already read, God outlines the terms of this contract. But if you read this language, all the families of the earth being blessed, that's pretty general, isn't it? That's pretty sketchy. It's not that we don't believe it, but it's not real specific in terms of, well, what is this blessing going to mean? What do you mean, bless all the families of the earth? It's rock solid. We've just seen that. There's no doubt about it's going to be fulfilled. But what is it? In 11 chapters, subsequent to the 12th chapter of Genesis, we find God, as we mentioned a few moments ago, coming back and reiterating, clarifying, amplifying, if you will, the terms. Not really adding anything new to the contract, but clarifying what he meant, what God meant, relative to the blessing of all the families of the earth. We're going to give you just the chapters. If you're interested in looking at these, it's fascinating to go back and look at the different times that God referenced the contract and what he had to say about it subsequent, which is in the nature of an elucidation, clarification of what he's meant by blessing all the families of the earth. Genesis chapters 13, 15, 17, 18, 22, 26, 28, 35, 46, and Exodus chapters 3 and 6. That's 11 chapters in addition to chapter 12. 12 chapters where he comes back and talks about this covenant. When we go back and we take a look at not only the 12th chapter, but everything that came after that, and we try to analyze these terms that God clarified through the subsequent references, we come to one conclusion, that we can categorize what God promised in the Abrahamic covenant into three parts. There's three parts to this contract. Just as there were three steps to bring the contract into existence, there are now three parts to the contract. Part one of the contract applies to Abraham personally, a personal benefit to Abraham himself. Part two of the contract applies to Abraham's seed. And it applies to the appointed work of this seed. And thanks mainly to the Apostle Paul, we know that this part of the contract is two-dimensional. It has a spiritual dimension and it has an earthly dimension to the seed. And part three of this contract is the part that you and I normally think about. All the families of the earth. That's part three of the contract. All mankind are the beneficiaries of this particular part. Okay, so we have three groups of beneficiaries. One is Abraham personally. Secondly is his seed. And thirdly is all the families of the earth. Let's consider just one portion of part one of this contract. Let's consider some thoughts from Genesis chapter 13, verses 14 and 15. Genesis chapter 13, verses 14 and 15. And the Lord said unto Abram, after that Lot was separated from him, lift up now thine eyes, and look from the place where thou art, northward, and southward, and eastward, and westward. For all the land which thou seest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever. God promised to give the land of Canaan to Abraham and to his seed forever. We suggest and we understand that this is a part, this is not a different contract. This is part of the Abrahamic covenant. I'll share with you a few references on this. Volume 2, page 45. Reprints 5178, 5182. Volume 2, page 45. Reprint 5178 and 5182. This part of the Abrahamic covenant is not only part of the covenant, we believe that it is a very important part of this covenant arrangement respecting Abraham and his seed. In the chapters of Genesis and Exodus that we just mentioned a few moments ago, God repeated this land promise at least 8 times after the account that we just read. He came back and repeated the land promise to Abraham at least 8 times. That certainly suggests that it was an important part and is an important part of the contract. And he not only repeated it to Abraham, but he also repeated it to Isaac and Jacob. And he also repeated it to Moses. So the land part was very important. But you say, no, wait a minute. St. Stephen tells us that God never delivered Abraham so much as a foot of the land of Canaan. So I say, no, wait a minute. How can that be? How can Stephen make that statement? Abraham was in Canaan. He set foot in it. That's what it took to bring the contract into existence. So how can Stephen say that Abraham didn't so much as have the ability or the opportunity to set foot on the promised land? We believe that the thought here is that Abraham did not get permanent possession of Canaan at that time when he lived. Because we know, if we look at the history of the promised land, and we look at what's happened over the last 4,000 years, we see that this land has fallen to the rule of the Philistines. This land has fallen to the rule of the Egyptians. It has fallen to the rule of the Babylonians. It has fallen to the rule of the Turks. In fact, if you go over there today, what do you see? I believe it's the remnants of the Turkish wall that's around the city of Jerusalem. Certainly indicates that the Turks had a rather strong presence and possession and control of that land for a period of time. But friends, Abraham is going to be resurrected. He's going to be brought back. And he's going to be given the land, just like God promised. And Stephen assures us that Abraham and his posterity are going to get this benefit that they were promised. The promise of giving the land to Abraham is just one of the personal benefits that we find as we read through the different accounts or the different references to the Abrahamic covenant in these various chapters of Genesis and Exodus. There's others. There's other personal benefits that will be given to him. And Abraham and those represented in him are going to obtain various other personal benefits as well. Now, we really don't talk too much about this part of the covenant. Why? Probably because, first of all, it's earthly. And second of all, it probably doesn't have the global appearance or the global perspective that the third part of the Abrahamic covenant has. But nevertheless, we suggest that it is an important part of this contractual arrangement that God made with Abraham. Let's talk now a little bit more detail about part two of the contract and the beneficiaries under this part two. Time and again, as we mentioned, God reiterated, clarified, elucidated the terms of the Abrahamic covenant. Reiterated to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Moses as far as what he would provide them with. And what did he say? Basically contained within this commitment was a promise to provide a seed. On at least five occasions that we were able to find, God specifically said that their seed would be either like two things, and we all know what those are, the stars of heaven or the sand of the seashore. That's exactly right. Let's consider one of these occasions. And we've already read the text back in Genesis, the 22nd chapter. But let's just kind of refocus our eyes for a moment on that particular text. Genesis 22, verses 17 and 18. Because this is where we find the reference to the seed. The Hebrew word that is seed here means posterity. Undoubtedly, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, every time that God made reference to providing them with a seed, undoubtedly they had the thought that God was going to promise them children. Quite a blessing to have children back then, wasn't it? Just as it's a blessing to have children today. They thought about it the same way, perhaps even more so. But who is God referring to here in Genesis chapter 22, verses 17, when he says, I will multiply thy seed as the stars and as the sand? Well, we believe that God here gives us a clue when we go to the very end of verse 17. And we see there that God says that this seed that he's talking about here is going to possess the gate of his enemies. Now we understand that possessing the gate of your enemies is a figure of speech. And it really represents being in control. Particularly back then with walled cities, if you controlled the gate, you controlled the city that was inside that gate. You controlled certainly who could go in, maybe even who could go out. The one who controls the gate is a figure of speech to reference those who are in charge. Who's in charge? The controller of the gate is another way of talking about the rulers. And the stars here, we now represent the spiritual rulers. Because Paul tells us that, doesn't he, in 1 Corinthians, the 15th chapter, verse 41. Where he says, star differeth from star in glory. And he talks about the terrestrial and the celestial in the context of that particular text. And he clearly identifies the stars here with the celestial, with those who will be changed to spirit beings. But Paul here gets more specific with this. Paul tells us that the glorified Jesus is the seed in Galatians, the 3rd chapter, verse 16. Galatians 3:16. Now to Abraham and his seed were the promises made. He saith not unto seeds as of many, but as of one, into thy seed, which is Christ. Jesus is the chief spiritual gatekeeper. Jesus is the one who's eventually going to destroy all the enemies of the earth, of the kingdom. But is he alone in this work? No. He's not alone in this work at all. Paul goes on to say that Abraham's seed includes Christ's body. When we look down to verse 29, and if ye be Christ, then are ye Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. the Isaac class. And we're here talking about, of course, the spiritual phase of the kingdom, the Christ head and body, the spiritual rulers, the spiritual gatekeepers, if you will. The sand of the seashore, we know, represents the earthly phase of the kingdom. Just who are the earthly gatekeepers? Well, Jesus tells us, if we go back to Luke, the 13th chapter, verse 28. Luke 13, 28. He says, "There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth when ye shall see Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and all the prophets in the kingdom of God, and you yourselves thrust out." So who are the earthly gatekeepers? Again, Jesus tells us, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and all the prophets. So we have the ancient worthies. We have the faithful Israel as being the special agents amongst men that's going to carry out this work. They are the earthly gatekeepers here as this seed. They're the perfect government amongst men. They're going to be the liaison, we know, between the spiritual phase and the world of mankind. And together it's the church, the ancient worthies, faithful Israel. These are the ones that comprise the main spiritual and earthly rulership of the kingdom of God. They're the seed of Abraham. They possess the gate. They're the ones in charge. They will be the instruments in carrying out this blessing. Briefly, very, very briefly, part three of the contract we know applies to all the families of the earth. We know that eventually, all in order to be blessed must become of the earthly seed of Abraham, and now a broader sense in which we use that term. Remember, it's the seed that blesses the families. The seed, so the seed's not blessing themselves, the seed is blessing the families. But now if we look at the seed in a larger sense, we know, based upon Genesis, the 17th chapter, verse 4, it says, Father, remember when Abram's name was changed to Abraham? He said, we're going to make him the father of many nations. How is a Jew going to become, or a Hebrew, going to become the father of a bunch of Gentiles? The Gentiles are going to become Hebrews. They're going to become Jews, Israelites. We say that the kingdom is Israelitish, and that's how it's going to work. That's how that God can say that Abraham is going to be the father of many nations, not just the nation of the Jews. In closing, there's just one other term, one other aspect of this Abrahamic covenant that we'd like to touch upon. You know, when you look at our contractual arrangements that you and I enter into, they're almost always have a limited life. Limited term. They have a specific time that they start and a specific time that they come to an end. We've considered with a lot of detail when the Abrahamic covenant begins, but when does it come to an end? When does it terminate? God Himself gives us the answer in Genesis, the 17th chapter, verse 7. Genesis 17:7. And I will establish my covenant between me and thee and thy seed after thee and their generations for an everlasting covenant to be a God unto thee and to thy seed after thee. And we won't take the time to read it, but if you look down also in verses 13 and 19, God repeats three times within a very short period of time that this covenant is an everlasting covenant. Friends, this grandest, this master contract has no termination date. God has made a perpetual commitment to carry out the terms of this contract. He's made a perpetual commitment to carry out this contract without end. It never ceases. Friends, have you heard of the gift that keeps on giving? God's master contract is the gift that keeps on giving forever.
Thank you, Brother Wesley. Brethren, we didn't know we had a spiritual lawyer amongst us, but we have one now. If you have any spiritual legal aspects you want to know about covenants that are in the Word of God, Brother Wesley is the man to see. And I think we all appreciated some of the legal aspects of this master covenant.